I'm Robert Cervelli, and this is Future Proofing, where we explore how many communities are taking charge of their own future in the face of our increasingly fragile world. I would like to acknowledge that this podcast originates from Nova Scotia, Canada, which is part of the unceded ancestral territory of the Mi'kmaq Indigenous peoples. The territory is called Mi'kma'ki.
All right, so we're just getting started. So on behalf of the Center for Local Prosperity, I would like to thank Matthew Winchester for being our podcast host, our guest for June. Matthew is an agriculture and agro-business entrepreneur and computer scientist with a passion for data. He is an Acadia University alumni based in Halifax and is currently on the board of FoodBite. FoodBite is a software startup that develops business-friendly software to help food processors and food exporters comply with the new federal food safety regulations. Additionally, Matthew assists companies navigate the journey of moving into food safety and helps to transition them into companies that use their manufacturing data to self-improve. As Matthew has said, we live in a data-rich world, and it only makes sense we leverage it as a resource to enhance our own ventures. And with that short introduction, Matthew, I would like to ask you, as a Nova Scotian who went to Acadia, what was the route to get you into agriculture?
Sure. So what happened with me is I was doing my master's, and that was under Dr. Darcy Benoit at Acadia. And I was thinking at the time, like, where am I going to go with this? What am I going to do with this? Because I was thinking about, I worked on the web census project. So I was thinking about, like, do I want to go for IBM? Do I want to do distributed computing? And there was just a local startup that one of my friends recommended to me, saying, like, hey, they're looking for some help from a guy like you. Do you want to help out? Sure, no problem. So I got connected with John Frost, who is the founder. And he started a company called AirHive. And what they did is they had drones that they would fly over farms in Rawdon, Nova Scotia, and they would look at blueberries, and they would look at different deformations in the farm. Like, think about it as, like, instead of flat land, there's like little deformities on the land here and there, and try to do a water table pooling analysis for the company. So he was already getting at the point where he's building, like, not just like a physical product, but like a data product to go with like a physical service that he can provide. And I was interested about like how this all works. And my background is not business. My background is very much like science and technology. So when John Frost was pitching this idea to me, I was like, this sounds wonderful. Like, sure, I'd love to help you out with this. So he hired me on. And very quickly, I ended up kind of taking on all the technology responsibilities. So eventually John just said, like, hey, how about I be the CEO and you just run all the technology, and just we talk to each other like every day, and we start figuring out how to grow this company. And I learned so much from John from a business point of view of like selling services is nice to pay the bills and stuff, but at the end of the day, you need to have some kind of product or a service package that you can sell through a subscription, so that can essentially be developed out not just for one customer, but for a whole bunch of customers, and you can serve a large market all with one stack of technology that you're building out. And I definitely had the technology chops, but learning a lot from John helped expand my mind as an individual for what was necessary. And John was really good at getting me to go to, there was at Acadia, they have these, at least they did in the past, had entrepreneurship competitions. So you could go in with an idea to try to help like the local industries and whatever, and say like, this is something that I think is going to be important. And I think this is something that people will be genuinely interested in. And I ended up doing quite well at these entrepreneurship competitions. And then it just happened one day where John came into the office at a box, started handing out shirts to everybody saying, we just got acquired. So woohoo. So, sudden life change where now I'm no longer the number two at this company. I'm just a nobody again. And I'm scratching my head going, well, what happens now? And what happened was John had a relationship with the CEO of this company that bought us out, supposedly they're friends. And I ended up working for this company called Precision Hawk in North Carolina I worked for them for 2.5 years. They basically said, like, you're coming on. It is what it is. It's because we need people like you to tell us how this technology we acquired works. So I started working for them. I was really happy. And then one day, basically the same thing happened, where one day Precision Hawk, all of a sudden, they had what's known as a clean sweep, which is we had a major investor come on. I'm not allowed to say who. And the CEO, the CFO, CSO, everybody out the door. You're all gone. And all your offices are empty. And we're going to hire up new executive people. So I said, well, maybe I don't belong here then. And at the same time, I noticed something that was really weird when I was in the United States working for this. And primarily what Precision Hawk did was similar to what AirHive was doing, just at a much more advanced level. Basically, our algorithms that we developed become another set of algorithms in their library for that they could do a service package with, because they were selling to everybody.
And this was agriculture based, right? This was all like something to do. Yeah. So they were looking at, I remember you saying about the drones, like the fields, like they would be able to tell you exactly kind of like water in fields or something, or?
Yes. So we use kind of little rinketing commercial drones in Nova Scotia, but they had developed a proprietary drone called Lancaster, which is a biplane. So it's like the size of, like, it's not just a little hobby one that you can hold in your hand. It's like the size of a vehicle. And you would take them off in a field and they would go out for hours and hours and hours, and they could do tens of thousands of acres. And they could get down to, it was 1.5 millimeter resolution. So you could get like very, very fine detailed data about everything that's happening on the ground because you're using LiDAR. And the LiDAR sensors allowed us to calculate everything from like how much water is in, like how much water do we see on the soil, how much greenery is there. So we could do a classification of like where the plants are growing, how much they're growing per week. We could start doing, like, if we see black bulrush, for example, was a problem with a disease that you could get in some of the plants. So then we could detect the growth rate of black bulrush that could then develop into some kind of like ROI or cost calculator for the business. And we developed that all for AirHive. And then all of that just got moved over to Precision Hawk after acquisition. And I just did the same thing. But then after a while, Precision Hawk started branching out to different industries. And they realized I'm really good at tinkering with stuff and building things. And they put me on another project where we would do drone flying over houses. And this is for residential insurance for housing. And the company started figuring out, like, can we look at buildings and start seeing deformations in roofs? Like, if we have the ability that we can see deformations in soil, can we look at deformations in roofs so that insurance industries have a better way of being able to calculate what they're going to charge for a premium?
Wow. Oh. One thing I wanted to, that I, because I know when you're in the States, that scale to me is important, because I spent most of my adult career in Alberta, where farms are huge, right? And I was a part owner of a farm in Saskatchewan for a while. And like, you can go leave in the morning on a tractor and be gone all day. Whereas in Nova Scotia, in the Maritimes, Atlantic Canada, we are smaller. So I was just wondering, like, do you have any reflections? And again, I know you're involved with the new AFAC, the Atlantic Food Action Coalition.
Well, yes, I am, Jill.
I love the acronym so much. But like, do you have any observations about like, because we're so small here? Do all these applications still work? Like, are they efficient at scale that's this small, or is this why things are, you know, where you get a drone that's gone for 8 hours looking at acres, 10,000 acres? Like, does our smallness preclude us from technology, I guess?
Oh, okay. So good question. AirHive did struggle with getting contracts for data, for like servicing data products to farms in Nova Scotia. I would say that you hit some of the topics, like some of the reasons. So it was, we have smaller farms here in Nova Scotia. They're not nearly the size of like canola in Alberta, which is massive industry. I would say that in Nova Scotia, what we were doing to try to figure out what kind of customers we were going for is the customers that always have the most money and have the biggest problems. So we were going after companies that were doing tree fruit, like high value horticulture, as it's called. So like grapes, blueberries, and stuff like that. So those were the companies that we were looking for, because they have the ability to identify problems and be able to put money down to solve those problems. But we weren't going and like trying to sell this to like onion farmers or carrot farmers or those kind of farmers, because those farms typically in Nova Scotia, even though some of them are large, because of the cash value of the crop, not a lot of them are interested, at least the ones that we spoke to, you know, pay a data firm to sit there and tell you where the water is on your farm. Because at the end of the day, they just go like, I don't really care that much about that. But I would say that this is more applicable to in the United States where you have large scale monocultures like Alberta. That was the big thing that we found is as soon as we started doing, the AirHive got acquired. I won't say the company we were working with, but there was a company in Saskatchewan that was doing a large scale monoculture from the prairies. And if something very familiar to Canada, and we had the ability that we could look at, I guess I can talk about it, the NDA is kind of gone now, but we built a machine learning engine at AirHive that could look at the plants growing, and we could tell you out of NPKS fertilizer, how much you needed of each in order to maximize growth output. And we could even tell you, because normally if you want to look at these kind of plants, you have to have what's called a hyperspectral imaging machine. These are giant machines that cost a lot of money. And what they do is they look at every wave band of light that there is. So like our eyes, we can see like visible light, but there's also a whole bunch of different light that we don't get. Like we don't see as human beings infrared. Well, a hyperspectral machine will look at all the wave bands of light and be able to tell you what it's seeing in all those different wave bands of light. And different wave bands have different properties. Like infrared, of course, can tell you whether or not there's thermal energy that it sees versus like X-ray versus like, you know, all these different wave bands. So the hyperspectral machine was looking at these plants and we could tell a whole bunch of different properties, and that is expensive. So ultimately what the company was looking to do is try to determine, is there some smaller set of bands of light that we can look at that's not going to cost us, you know, like $100,000 for machine, something we could do like say on a mobile phone. So can we use like a visible light spectrum to look at plants and be able to do the same kind of calculations you're doing now? And if you can tell us the bands of light, we can hire a company to go out there and build lenses to whether we can put on an iPhone that translates its current data into a more refined data set, so you get even higher precision off the current data. And I was like, yeah, sure. So like we figured that out. And
okay. So I'm going to mention something that is not what you just talked about, but like I use iNaturalist. Have you ever used that?
No. So what's this?
It's an app it's for plant identification, or at least that's what, because I worked on the sand barrens when I was working with the Clean the Annapolis River project. And so like there are specific plants that are only found in the sand barrens, which is really only around that kind of Kingston area. But iNaturalist is about trying to not only identify, but then also help place. And if it's a species at risk, it won't pinpoint where it's been found. It gives a band, right? So people aren't going to go and do something to the poor plant or the poor whatever. But I'm just wondering, like, I'm thinking iNaturalist is, I am a Luddite and it's user-friendly to me. Do you foresee there being, like with what you were talking about, like that spectral stuff is not for a farmer. It's not for like a conservationist or whatever, but is there a way of taking that and sort of trying to make a tool that, and again, I guess there's, I don't know where the profit is in this changeover, but like, I'm thinking with all of this data and information, like how do we do citizen science to fit in with it so that, you know, overall and out, you know, in the Atlantic provinces, we are, you know, towards our goal of food security, food, you know, sovereignty, being the best we can at growing with the changes in the climate, which is my area of expertise, that are happening right now, including, and I know you've been impacted, these fires, right? Like, do you foresee there being a model in which we could come up with a tool that I don't know if there's a profit motive to be made in it, but you know, like that people like me can contribute into it?
So by the problem is you're trying to identify a certain species. So you're trying to like take a camera and point it at a plant and say, what is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Potentially, like we would have to build models off of one. Look on their website right now, and it's the great sundew Drosera. What is this? It's some kind of weird looking plant, Drosera angelica. So like, if you give me, you know, like a couple million pictures of this, I could like look at it and say, okay, well, let's build a machine learning algorithm that can identify that. Sure. Like that's feasible. What's the model off of it? Essentially, all of these models are stipulated off of, like, let's say if you're a tech entrepreneur, I do this with every single person, is you're only doing one of two things, which is you are either selling nutritional pills or you're selling painkillers to another company. So you are either selling a company nutritional pills, which is they could do something that they couldn't do before by making them stronger, or you're selling them painkillers where you're taking something that they were doing currently and you're minimizing the pain that the company feels. So
that's
which one of those
do you want? Great analogy. Oh yeah. My God. Thank you for simplifying it into my language. That's awesome. So what's your next, I know you probably don't know exactly what's happening, but where are our greatest needs? Or have you thought about where the greatest needs where technology and entrepreneurialism can help us in Nova Scotia and Atlantic Canada from a farming, agriculture, or other perspective?
Ooh, okay. So this is a good question. It is a mixed bag because if you look at, again, I mentioned high horticulture. I would say that there's different kinds of farms in Nova Scotia. You have I go to the Horticulture Congress in Nova Scotia almost every year. I would say that there are different communities of farming with not so much geographical, but like interest-based communities of farming. So you can have farms like Elmridge Farms, which are like no spray farms, which are just specifically like, we're not going to use pesticides. We're not interested in any of this crap. We're just going to do it the old fashioned way because it's the way that we consider to be sustainable and healthy for customers. And then you can have other ones that are just doing monocultures, which are like big companies that are selling internationally. They're not really like the sales that they do locally are not too interesting to them unless somebody's Loblaws wants to buy a huge bulk amount of it and sell it through their chains. They're mostly about trying to get into the American market because you can make so much more money selling Canadian fresh fruit and vegetables in the American market than you can in your local markets. So I would say like those kind of farms do different things. There's even like I remember there was a consultant I was talking to that in PEI, there's like a non-GMO push. The whole group is trying to set up like one side of the island that wants to do, at least from what this consultant explained to me, non-GMO soybeans, just have like different varieties of soybeans that have different kind of impacts on the product that you want to make. Because a lot of the soybeans are going into different, like, are you familiar with like flexitarian? Yeah. So yes. Like going into a lot of vegan flexitarian food now as like a protein replacement. You want different kinds of GMO, non-GMO soybeans so you can have different flavors, different profiles for texture and stuff like that. So there's a whole bunch of different farming groups in Atlantic Canada, a wild mix versus like when I am in Saskatchewan and I talk to a farmer, it's pretty clear to me that he's probably going to be wheat or canola.
Yeah.
Probably one of those two.
Yeah. Well, and I guess this bodes the question about scale then. So as an entrepreneur, I mean, mind you, you did this at Acadia and it was a product that was, you know, that was made for, you know, I know you met with a bunch of companies, even ones we know that are in Wolfville in that area. What is, as far as geographic or size, how important is that to the reality of building a successful application, like a technological application? That's the end of my tech talk for you.
Oh, okay. I would say the technological application, or like where does it begin? Where does it end? It begins with I remember a talk. It was I forget the guy's name. It was at a conference in Toronto I went to, I think was it Velocity? I can't remember the name of it now. And there was one of the co-founders of Gmail there, and he explained it on stage quite eloquently, which is your customer has to be in so much pain that it feels like they're trapped under a boulder, their arm is trapped under a boulder, and that they're going to die within moments. And you come over and say, I could remove that boulder from you if only you could just sign this letter of intent, please. And if you can get enough people that have boulders trapped, you know, have boulders on top of them, trapping them on the ground, and can get some letters of intent, well, maybe you actually have like a, you know, potential business model there. But it comes down to there's so many opportunities from companies that I see do rescued food versus food logistics versus food bite with food safety versus, you know, how to organize, you know, what kind of seeds you want to plant and stuff like that. an agricultural community is not just, it's not just farms. Like, we always have to think about, like, farmers like to, people like to think as farmers is like a person wearing an overall and going out in the field and, like, you know, planting seeds and, you know, like watering and fertilizing it and eventually like harvesting. But farms are getting more advanced now, where a lot of farms, and this is why Food Bank got into the food safety business in Wolfville, a lot of farms are not really farms anymore. Like, a lot of them from the food safety angle are becoming food processors, where you have a farm and then they say, wow, I can make so much more money by turning my carrots into carrot juice. So they make a product under that company, the farm company, with its name and its logo, and they make carrot juice. And now all of a sudden, when the government comes by and they say, what are you? The company says, oh, I'm a farm. And then they point at the carrot juice and they say, no, you're a food processor. You may think you're a farm, but you're a food processor now. Wow. So yeah. things are complicated in Nova Scotia because you have a bunch of companies doing a bunch of different things. And everybody is just like this cacophony of different venture ideas and different activities. Versus if I go to, say, Guelph, it's like very clear, like, these are farms and they're growing like this one crop. Like, I'm going to do one crop or two crops. And all the food companies that do food processing are over there at the Guelph Innovation Center, or like in this area. And they're going to be taking products that we make and turn them into other things. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there's a clear established pipeline is a better way of saying.
That gives me two follow-up questions, and I'm watching the time. One of the things is about that whole idea of value added, right? In Nova Scotia, it sounds like farms are doing that, but is that because it's kind of mandatory? Like, I know in Alberta, my PhD I did on agriculture in Southern Alberta, so I get a chance to interview a lot of farmers. And for most of those farmers in Southern Alberta, on fairly large farms, either the, like, in a typical husband-wife situation, one of them has to work in town, right? Like, they can't survive financially. And those are on big farms. And then we have these smaller ones here in Nova Scotia. So is that value added something that farms should be all thinking about? Like, you shouldn't just be thinking about yourself as a farm. You should be thinking vertically or yeah. Any comments on that? And then I have one other one.
My knowledge of what a farmer needs to do in order to grow is very limited. I was born, mind you, on a chicken farm in Southern Nova Scotia. So I'm familiar with, like, raising chickens and growing my own crops and stuff like that. But what a farm should do, you should always be looking to expand your business and find new ways to generate revenue. The biggest problem that I see with farmers is that, like, I can go to a farm I was in the Valley recently, and I can go and buy a 10-pound bag of Honeycrisp for $6 right off the farm. Versus if I go to Superstore down the road, it's like $15, $16 for the same bag. Yeah. So that's a huge markup, like almost a 300% markup just for moving it 1 hour to the south. Mm. So the reason why that markup happens is that these grocery stores are closer to the customer. And one of the key things I learned from being in the startup community is whoever's closer to the customer wins. They get the most revenue, they get the better traction with the customer, better relationships with the customer gets more familiar with that company.
Well, and I guess, and that's the thing, I guess from what I was kind of getting at is for me, is it that we have to think about farming as sort of all parts of the food industry, or is there still like a space for people that just want to grow carrots, right? And I think for people that just want to grow carrots, what I'm hearing from you is that if you're just growing carrots on the same amount of land, your growth potential is pretty stunted. Whereas if you go into processing and making carrot juice, you're expanding and you're finding new value or a higher value for your product.
Yeah.
When I do have a marketing degree, which I really don't like because I found marketing very evil, but I do have one. So I understand what you've just said. And I guess my other question for you is, you know, sort of, do you think people like you, like smart entrepreneurs that have done well, can you stay in focus in Atlantic Canada? Or are you like, you know, to be at your potential, do you need to go somewhere else or connect with other larger spaces?
You, Okay. Really good question here. Interesting that we're going this angle. For technology, can you build a tech company here in Nova Scotia and be successful? Yes. Can you, now that you have a tech company and you're selling product to customers, can you potentially grow that company here in Nova Scotia? Yes. I did it myself. I saw other companies do it, especially in the agricultural space. Can you do, like, say, a seed round investment here? Are you familiar with, like, pre-seed, seed, series A investments?
I know a little bit, but I'm assuming some of the audience might not. So give us the 101.
Okay. So let's say if you're a tech company, you need to be capitalized. You have to be able to pull in a lot of money so you can be able to grow the company at a steady rate. And doing that off the back of subscriptions or sales is one avenue of doing it. But ultimately, you need to be able to pull in a lot of money, because that evil marketing degree that you got is very important for tech companies in order to nail down marketing, so that you have a paid customer acquisition model is really the only way to grow as a tech company. You have to be able to say, I can pay, like, I build a machine and I can put in a dollar, and for every dollar I put in, I get $1.40 back or $1.50 back. And you have to be able to constantly update that model, because that's how tech companies either drown or take off flying. When it comes to capitalization, I would say that Nova Scotia, Greg Kerwin has talked about this in length, the founder of Sperry. He said that it is very difficult to capitalize with ideas here in Nova Scotia, because a lot of times investors in this region like to think, and this isn't just me throwing stones at them, but to just call a spade a spade, a lot of people like to think of, like, let's grow our community, let's figure out something that can, like, solve our problems here in Atlantic Canada. Versus Greg says, like, if you go to Silicon Valley, it's how do we take over this entire industry and become billionaires? So the difference between the culture of these two communities is quite vast, where essentially they're trying to achieve two different things. And you have to start figuring out, do you want to become a billionaire, create a $1 billion company and manage all of that? Or do you want to grow something here slowly, sustainably, where you don't have to take on capitalization, knowing that it's going to be five times as long for you to grow the company. You're going to have way more headaches. It's going to be much more painful when you feel customer churn versus, you know, just jump on the cash cow of Silicon Valley and invest, like, get all that sweet, sweet investor money in the company. And that's a decision you have to make as a founder. I would say that for a pre-seed investment here, it's pretty good. I think this community, like, kind of gets, like, at that stage when you're just trying to test out a new piece of technology and people want to give you money to be customers, be employees, be investors, to kind of, like, come in early and not just financially invest, but kind of, like, emotionally invest in what you're trying to achieve. I think this is a great community to do that. But I would say once when you get to a seed round investment where you should have a paid acquisition model, things get a little dicey here. There's, like, a couple investors that are good at that. And outside of that, a lot of investors here don't have enough experience to understand what that means for a tech company. At least the one, I don't know, like, maybe some of the ones that I've talked to were not so great, but I would say that there's a handful here in Nova Scotia that get that. And then when you want to go big and, you know, want to sell all over the world and become, like, a $1 billion company, there's only, like, one guy I know in Nova Scotia that can help you with that, that can help with a Series A financing round.
Okay. Wow.
So, it is more difficult to do it here in Nova Scotia, of course. And as soon as you try, I can say personally from experience, as soon as I try to reach out to different investment communities, because it's food, and food, as much as, like, we like to kind of snub our nose at the concept of food sovereignty, I can say if you go to Toronto and talk about, like, oh, I want to be part of the food community, they're like, yeah, we want to be part of, like, what you're doing too, and you should totally move here and, like, be part of our food community.
Aha, the draw to Toronto.
Because they want you in that community, right? So I can say that there's always going to be a trade-off you have to make as a entrepreneur. You have to make that decision and you have to live with the consequences. I decided to start it here and I grew the company, did a really good job, ended up getting acquired, and now I'm finding my next thing.
Yeah. Well, on behalf of the people that are working on trying to build food security and sovereignty in Atlantic Canada, I hope you stay. I hope you find that next gem here. And I think this kind of wraps us up. Like, this is a good place to end. And Matthew, we met because we were going to the same food conference. I picked you up at Acadia and we drove a couple hours. And I just have to say, like, I love that is like how some of the best kind of meetings happen, because, you know, I've been thinking a lot about our conversations and your angle on this is so different. Like, I'm an economist, so mine is also different than most of the other people that are part of AFAC, but they need us, first of all. And I also think that the idea that we can become more efficient and more sustainable and work toward food sovereignty by actually connecting in with the idea, like those kind of cutting edge ideas, that's not where my mind goes. And I know for a lot of farmers, it's the day-to-day getting it done. So having these kind of exchanges and, you know, I'm excited to see what happens with the Atlantic Food Action Coalition, AFAC, because we're bringing together some pretty cool, you know, the intersection amongst these different disciplines is pretty exciting to me.
Yeah, absolutely. We got a wide range of folks. I'll say that. We got a whole bunch of different people. It's an interesting group because we all seem to have reached the same conclusion where we're generally unhappy with the direction of the food industry in Atlantic Canada, with where we're going, where everybody just buys from grocery stores and we mostly are buying Ontario or American or Mexican or even European food. We're not seeing a lot of what we would consider to be historical foods or like local foods at these stores. And we're is kind of washing away a long historical identity of what we're doing. And I think we can all point at that and say that's generally a bad thing, but our group is still a little splintered on what is the boogeyman, as I like to call it. So like, what can we point at that says like, this is the thing causing the problem. And as much as we all like to wave our hands and say big bad corporations, I think it's more of those are a means to an end. Corporations like to make money off of problems, not necessarily cause the problems. So what is the thing that's causing the problem here in Atlantic Canada? I'm still working on that project.
Stay tuned, folks. There'll be more podcasts trying to explore this whole thing. Be the Boogeyman series. Maybe we'll do that.
Maybe. Who knows?
All right. Well, I just want to say, Matthew, thank you so much for taking the time, for being flexible with my schedule. And we know that the fires have impacted your family. So I'm just going to say, I just send everybody in your end of this province a lot of love and a lot of light, because this is a big wake up call for us.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to stop the recording. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Have a good one, Jillian.